Go ahead.
May it please the court. Hannah Comstock on behalf of the petitioner, Mr. Lopez Marroquin. I want to just jump right in. I'm going to be discussing the aggravated felony issue.
Yeah, you have a jump off spot, so go for it.
So just to kind of pick up where the prior argument left off, Judge Callahan and Judge Nguyen, I think that y'all touched the precise issue before this court, is that Duenas-Alvarez did not conduct the divisibility inquiry that Mathis requires. And in fact, Duenas-Alvarez used a divisibility approach that was explicitly rejected in Mathis. And for that reason, Duenas-Alvarez is clearly irreconcilable with Mathis, and that triggers this court's GAMI authority to overrule a prior panel opinion.
Judge Thomas didn't do it when he had, they didn't do it when they had the chance, so the concurrence doesn't really, they don't really address that issue. He said it would be good for the court to look at that at some point, but we don't know if he meant it would be good to go en banc. We don't know what it, I wasn't in conference, and Judge Nguyen would be sworn to secrecy as to what they might have talked about, so we don't know.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the fact that Judge Thomas wrote a concurrence on the, in addition to the majority opinion, which he also authored, to outline precisely why these two cases are clearly irreconcilable is extremely telling about, you know, where this court is right now and why it's imperative for this court to act and overrule Duenas-Alvarez at this point. Judge Thomas's concurrence was clear that Mathis altered the legal landscape and that when we apply the Mathis factors, Duenas-Alvarez can no longer stand.
I'm going to concede at least tension, but push me beyond tension.
I was going to ask something, a question along the same lines. I think it can be argued, given Chief Judge Thomas's concurrence, that there's definite tension there that at some point the circuit ought to think about going en banc to correct, but it wasn't necessarily irreconcilable. So there's an argument to be made there, given how that opinion and concurrence was structured. How would you respond to that?
Your Honors, it is far more than a tension when we look at exactly what Duenas-Alvarez did and exactly what Mathis requires now. Duenas-Alvarez, again, relied solely on the disjunctive phrasing. And when we look at the Mathis factors, it tells courts to look at first how state case law has treated the statute and whether it, state courts have said that it creates elements or means as to the disjunctively phrased terms. And then you go to the statutory text on its face. And under that element, Mathis was clear. Disjunctive phrasing does not necessarily mean that the statute creates elements. And then
I have trouble, though, with Vidal. In terms of that, Vidal plainly says one who is convicted as an accessory after the fact of theft cannot have said to have committed elements of a generic theft. And then also, accessory liability arises only after a completed crime. Therefore, as a logical matter under 10851, how can an accessory after the fact be said to have stolen the car with the intent to deprive the owner of possession? So that's where that's making my head spin.
I understand, Your Honor. And when we look at 10851 and its legislative history and where exactly it sits in the California vehicle theft.
If you want to be really straight, you have to call it 10851.
10851. Yeah. when we look at 10851 and where it sits in the way that California has created vehicle theft statutes, the California legislature really intended for the statute to overlap over misdemeanor joyriding, right, which has since been kind of collapsed into 10851, and grand theft. And so the California legislature and courts have interpreted this statute, you know, how the California legislature wanted it to, which is that it is very loose and that really all it requires is that somebody be in a car that is not their own. And the way that a particular factual scenario can arise is to satisfy.
But 10851 requires an intent. Joyriding is different.
Well, so joyriding has since been collapsed into 10851, misdemeanor joyriding. So it is encompassed within 10851. And when we look at the statutory language of 10851, it is riddled with disjunctive phrasing. And California courts have been quite clear that no particular, you know, a prosecutor doesn't have to proceed or specify which of the terms that it's using. And when California courts explain or articulate the elements of 10851, they'll use the same three elements, none of which require a particular theory of liability. And as I was saying earlier, I think that when we look at, you know, the way a particular statute or the way a certain factual scenario could arise, it could be somebody in a car that's not their own driving that vehicle, and or they could be even a passenger of the vehicle, and it's completely unclear exactly what they may or may not have done to give rise to the 108.51 charge itself. But the mere fact of being in that car alone is sufficient. But if this court, for those reasons, it's clear that under state case law, that 108.51 does not create elements. It creates means as to the liability term. And when we look at the statute on its face, that confirms our interpretation, which is that, you know, Mathis tells us that a statute that assigns particular consequences or discrete consequences, sentencing consequences, to a disjunctive phrase, that is a hallmark of an element, and we very clearly do not have that here when we look at 108.51 subsection A. And then when we look at if those two factors don't compel a finding of an element, which is right what Mathis requires, then this court can look at a peek of the record of conviction in these types of cases, and Vidal is quite instructive on this point. In footnote 27, Vidal says that the record of conviction in 108.51 cases are generally more often than not pled to the generic.
Oh, actually, you've gone past your 6 minutes. You've gone 6.5.
I recognize that, Your Honor. I will give time to my co-counsel now.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I will address the merits.
Okay, tell us who you are, just so that we can differentiate that on the record.
Emily Chertoff for Mr. Lopez, Your Honor.
Okay.
Regardless of how this court comes down on the aggravated felony issue, it must still resolve Mr. Lopez's CAT and withholding claims. Remember,
I have a question. How does he get asylum and cancellation and all of those?
So, Your Honor, if this court were to grant remand on the AGFEL under either of the theories that we've set forth in the brief, that would, with nothing else from this court, make him eligible purely for cancellation of removal. It would not make him eligible for asylum unless this court addresses the particularly serious crime issue and remands on that. And even were this court to address the AGFEL issue and the particularly serious crime and grant remand on both of those issues, withholding and CAT are two entirely separate statutory bases for relief. And if the court's going to remand on the AGFEL and on the particularly serious crime, those are also issues the court should remand on because the errors on those issues can't stand.
So why is he barred by the, I couldn't tell from the record. I mean, it's been a long time. Why does he get to claim asylum now?
Your Honor, when a person has had a green card and then they lose that green card, they are eligible to apply for asylum. So the 1 year bar would not apply in that situation.
Oh, okay. So it's timely. I know they didn't contest it, but I was trying to figure that out. I wasn't sure. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
I want to emphasize 3 points. First, the agency ignored Mr. Lopez's sexual orientation in its CAT analysis. This error is fatal to the agency's CAT analysis because the immigration judge failed to follow the Cole line of cases. Mr. Lopez provided credible and uncontroverted testimony that he is a gay man and that he fears harm if he is returned to El Salvador. Despite corroborating country conditions evidence, the immigration judge ignored this risk of torture in the CAT analysis.
Well, okay, that, I'm trying to, you claim that in denying the CAT relief, the IJ considered only whether he would experience torture due to his mental conditions rather than the aggregate risk of torture compounded by his homosexuality, particularly that if he didn't wind up in a Salvadorian hospital. But it looks like the IJ focused on the mental conditions, but the IJ did discuss in the other record evidence in assessing his withholding claim, the other things that you talked about.
So hearings are kind of a, you know, they're not just, they don't, everything fits in a box. So it, all of the things that you're saying the IJ ignored were talked about, just didn't as neatly handle it as you would expect. So I'm not sure I agree on that.
I understand what Your Honor is saying, and I think it's helpful to disaggregate the discussion of the facts and the opinion, because this is one of the things that was so complicated and unclear about the immigration judge's decision. Withholding and CAT are completely separate analyses, and you apply a separate standard as the immigration judge. So withholding asks, just as to the particular social group that our client articulated on the basis of his sexual orientation, does he have a 50% risk of persecution just on that basis? The CAT inquiry does not ask that. CAT asks whether there's more than a 50% risk of torture on the basis of every single risk that the person would face if they're deported to the country of origin. So the finding on the withholding, I completely understand what Judge Callahan is saying about the way that the hearing is conducted, but it can't be a sufficient analysis for the CAT claim, because it's not the same legal standard. And the immigration judge should have analyzed the risks all together and then aggregated them to see if they met the 50% threshold.
So is your client just, I kind of like to contextually know what's going on. At some point your client was detained. Is your client still detained?
Unfortunately, he is, Your Honor.
And so, and he had been homeless previously since 2006 or something like that, or for a long time?
He's been homeless for several years, Your Honor.
Okay. So,
it is another factor that the government, that the immigration judge did not consider in her CAT analysis, and that would go to both the sexual orientation and the mental health, because they raise his risk of torture for both of those reasons. I see that my time is running short, so if the court has no further questions on the CAT analysis, just to quickly summarize, we are also asking for remand on the withholding due to errors of law and fact that we detailed in our brief on that issue, and on the particularly serious crime finding because the immigration judge failed to correctly apply Gomez-Sanchez. Each of these three errors affected Mr. Lopez's eligibility for relief, and they would continue to do so even if this court were to grant remand on the aggravated felony. So for that reason, we request remand to the BIA for resolution of all three of those errors. And if the court...
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
We'll reserve the balance for your co-counsel for rebuttal. All right, we're ready for the government.
May it please the court, Joseph O'Connell on behalf of the Attorney General. Hello, Your Honors. Hello, opposing counsel. I know this is a complicated case, and so I will try to be as brief as possible. I know there's a lot of issues. I'm going to go as fast as I can while allowing for as much time for questions as I can, but I know that there's five or six very complicated issues, so I'm going to try to work through them. So I just have a few points to say about the Duenas-Alvarez case and whether or not Mathis is clearly irreconcilable. So I just want to really go quickly take a broader view of the entire case and to see what Mathis actually did. So first, this concept of elements versus means has been around for a really long time. The idea goes back 100 years, but then we'll jump to 2007. And so over two dissents in Vidal, the court held this Section 10.851 is not categorically a theft offense because it includes accessory after the fact liability. So now we know it's broader. Then you jump to 2013, and then you have death camps. I don't know if I'm saying that case name right or not, but we call it death camps in this office. So in DeCamps held that the modified categorical approach only applies to divisible statutes. A divisible statute is one that creates separate crimes with different elements. A few months after DeCamps, the court issued Duenas-Alvarez. And in Duenas-Alvarez, it didn't just do the disjunctive. It cited DeCamps, which held that Section 10.851 is divisible. But what it also did is that it relied on Vidal. And then it proceeded to the modified categorical approach. That's important, because Vidal did a very deep dive into the state case law on what you need to prove, why it's broader than the generic definition of theft. And broader than the generic definition of theft because of that intent element in terms of accessory after the fact. So the next year, in 2014, we get the decision in Rendon. And then Rendon relies on DeCamps, and it holds that the statutory alternatives must be found unanimously. And not only that, Rendon said that Duenas-Alvarez is consistent with the approach that it was laying out. So Rendon cites explicitly Duenas-Alvarez. That's footnote 11. After that, the en banc court confirmed this Rendon approach the next year in Almanza-Arenas. And again, I think the court cited Duenas-Alvarez favorably in that case. So then we arrive at Mathis in 2016. So what we have to do is ask what Mathis actually did. It didn't start from scratch, which is why I went through that whole history using up 2.5 minutes of my time. What it actually did was resolve a circuit split, and it resolved the circuit split in this court's favor. And so in doing so, the Supreme Court cited Rendon favorably, and as noted, Rendon cited Duenas-Alvarez favorably on two separate occasions, the latter of which stating that Duenas-Alvarez is consistent with the elements versus means test. So, again, we have to keep in mind the posture of this case, and the only question before the court today on this issue is whether Duenas-Alvarez is clearly irreconcilable with Mathis. And because Mathis resolved the circuit split in favor of this court's case law that cited Duenas-Alvarez with approval, the court should conclude that not only is Duenas-Alvarez not clearly irreconcilable with Mathis, but if you look at Duenas-Alvarez and the fact that it cited Vidal, which went did such a deep dive into the state case law, I would think that Duenas-Alvarez is consistent with Mathis. So there's a reason the court has cited to it as binding precedent on multiple occasions, including post-Mathis. If there's any questions on that, I'd be happy to answer them. Or I can just move to the next one.
I think everyone has questions, but they're deep, okay. Questions and how difficult the issue is.
They really are, and Your Honor was right when she said that, you know, they keep making it more complicated when they're trying to simplify it. I'll make this last point about Mathis. So Mathis cites death camps favorably 14 times in the majority opinion. And not only that, but the Mathis court cited death camps to refute the dissent's argument, which claimed that the Supreme Court prior case law did not intend to distinguish between statutes listing elements versus means. The Mathis court rejected that contention, it quoted Descamps, and it said all those decisions rested on the premise that the laws contain statutory phrases that cover different crimes and not different methods. In other words, elements and not means. And so that there's this funny little line in Mathis from Justice Kagan in the majority, and so she's talking about this, and she says, a good rule of thumb for reading our decisions is that what they say and what they mean are one and the same. And I think that is important because, you know, Duenas-Alvarez cited the elements, and Mathis basically said, look, you got to look at the elements to compare it to the state crime.
The problem here is compounded by the fact that I don't think 10851 is a very well written statute. And the fact that in California law, those of us that have lived it for 20 years, either as a judge or a prosecutor or a defense attorney or whatever, you know, I never saw it, the accessory part, prosecuted, but it says it plainly. So what does, you know, it just isn't
right.
Looking at California law on this doesn't totally clear it up. And I think some people have argued if you can't really tell from the California law, but doesn't the ambiguity inure to the petitioner or the defendant or something along those lines?
I don't think so. I would disagree with that. So with that in mind, I mean, we're bound by Vidal, which says that it applies to accessory after the fact. But again, the second dissent in Vidal noted that in the 84-year history, I guess it's now 97-year history, they haven't found a case that applies it implicitly that sense.
I guess I appreciate your confidence and how you've gone through all of this. Would you be willing to concede that there might be a little tension, however?
Sure. But I would concede that, but I think a better characterization, yes, I would concede that. Yes, of course. But I think a better characterization of Duenas-Alvarez is not that it's inconsistent, but that we would want a more fulsome analysis. And I mean, you could say that about any decision, especially these criminal categorical approach, modified categorical approach decisions. They're so complicated. And yeah, you want more analysis. You want more state case law. You can help another state case that says something. But the fact that it cited the Vidal, yeah, there's some tension, but yeah, I'd like to see, you know, I'd like a more fulsome analysis. And if we were deciding the issue de novo, would it be a little more fulsome, a little bit different? For sure. I think so. But again, the only question before this court is clear irreconcilability. And what Mathis did was resolve the circuit split in this court's favor, which sided Rendon, and Rendon sided Duenas Alvarez favorably. And so I don't understand how you can suggest that those are now clearly irreconcilable, because Mathis essentially agreed with that sort of analysis. It didn't.
I think this panel, if we so chose, and I'm not saying we haven't even discussed this because we haven't talked mm-hmm. about the case, but we could sua sponte call this case en banc, ask the court to consider everything. And
I think that's right. Yeah. I can't, as a trial attorney, I'm not even allowed to ask for it, I believe. I don't even know if I could accept it if the court wanted to do it. I know it might have to go through the Solicitor General's office. I remember my first moot court for our old assistant director, and I asked for something like that, and he, not breaking character, he said, you would have to ask your Solicitor General about that. So, yes, I'm not disagreeing with that, but I don't have any authority to talk about en banc or not. My point, sorry.
We have the authority if we choose.
Of course, yeah, sure, yeah.
Call cases sua sponte and ask the court to do that. We have that.
I believe so, yeah. So I'm going to jump right to the next issue, which is the modified categorical approach. And this implicates the last case as well. I was unlucky enough to not have my petitioner concede the second argument. But what we have here is conviction documents that establish that Mr. Lopez was convicted as a principal. So the charging document alleges that he drove and took someone else's vehicle, and that he did so with the intent to deprive the owner of his property. The minute order shows that he pled guilty to count one. The abstract identifies guilty plea to count one. The cites are all in the record. We cited to him. So by comparison, this is where Vidal and Arriaga-Pinon are different. The defendant pled guilty only to the generalized language of the statute and not to a specific count. Here, Mr. Lopez pled guilty to driving and taking someone else's vehicle with the intent to deprive a specific person of that property. So count one doesn't match up with anything even remotely resembling accessory after the fact liability. So with that in mind, in California, to prove accessory after the fact, the state has to show, and this is under Section 32, the state has to show a felony, but the second element is, the state has to show the defendant harbored, concealed, or aided a principal in that felony with the specific intent that the principal avoid or escape arrest, trial, conviction, etc. There's nothing in Mr. Lopez's charging document that even remotely resembles harboring, concealing, aiding, anything like that. So our position is that it's driving or taking, it doesn't matter. What really matters is the intent to deprive, the combination thereof. It's the intent to deprive. So this case actually has both, drive and take. It cites the general language of the statute first in all caps, and then it goes into lower.
Do you want to address the withholding in the cap?
Sure. I'll jump right to it. Can I call it particularly serious crime PSC? Because I just have a hard time saying it out loud. This is a PSC determination. So he's not even eligible.
That's what it is.
Okay. Mr. Lopez is not eligible even to apply for withholding because his conviction constitutes a particularly serious crime under the Frantescu factors. Now, there's generally no jurisdiction to address that based on the nature of the conviction, the circumstances, all that stuff. So the petitioner makes his argument saying that the immigration judge mischaracterized the record, but there's nothing in the record indicating the onset of Mr. Lopez's schizophrenic symptoms. The IJ noted that she noted that there were bipolar and depression, but he had not yet been diagnosed. There's no factual finding. There's no evidence in the record indicating when Mr. Lopez started experiencing those symptoms. The earliest thing we have is 2001 when he started to be treated.
Why is there a need for formal diagnosis, counsel?
There is no need, and there was no finding right. That there was a need. All the immigration judge did, she noted that he was not yet diagnosed. And so the board gave him the benefit of the doubt on review and said even if he was suffering from schizophrenia, even assuming that was the case, it's still a PSC. And so again, the court can't reweigh the factors. They only have to look to whether or not there's a legal error. And so it doesn't matter. You're absolutely correct as to when the onset of his symptoms occurred. His conviction or his crime occurred in August 2000. But we don't know if he was suffering from schizophrenic symptoms, and there is no evidence in the record either way. So we really don't know. And so there was no actual factual finding. And so the immigration judge didn't even make an error. She just said he wasn't yet diagnosed with schizophrenia. And the diagnosis is different from the onset of the symptoms. And so there's no error in that. And then the board cleaned it up by saying, even assuming he was, it's still a PSC. And so, again, there's no the court has no jurisdiction to reweigh those factors. But again, that shows that there's no legal error. And so I would love to move to the CAT stuff because I'm limited on time. I've only got a couple minutes left.
Go ahead.
Okay. So Mr. Lopez's claim is that the agency failed to consider the evidence in the aggregate, and I think that's incorrect. So when you look at the argument in petitioner's opening brief, I'm sorry if I'm going fast, I'm running out of time. It refers to the quote-unquote record evidence, and it points back up to the statement of facts. And when you look at the statement of facts, it directs to – Mr. Lopez points to this report in the Georgetown Law Center. And the Georgetown report says that members of the LGBTQ community have been targeted. So I'm not dismissing this evidence, but I am saying that it doesn't compel the conclusion that Mr. Lopez will be tortured in El Salvador with the acquiescence of government officials. So as to the claim that the agency didn't consider that evidence, I would disagree with that as well. So this is a 3,000-page record. The IJ devotes an entire paragraph to discussing this Georgetown article. And I know the court doesn't like the catch-all phrase, but when you add the catch-all phrase after considering all of this evidence in the record, and then you add that to the fact that there was an entire paragraph dedicated to the Georgetown article about how LGBTQ persons are targeted and when, I think that's enough to say that the agency considered this in the aggregate. And so at the 28J, it was Cornell. There's another important point here that we made in our response 28J is that there is this alternative finding, and I wish I would have made this point better in our brief, but it hasn't even been challenged in the petitioner's opening brief, that there's still no acquiescence on the part of the Salvadoran government. So that's an alternative finding. Setting aside the aggregation argument, Mr. Lopez has not challenged that acquiescence finding in any regard. And if you look at the language of the agency decision, is that the I can read it to you right now. I've got it highlighted here. It says he has not shown acquiescence, specific intent to cause severe pain or suffering in its mental health facilities or otherwise. That sort of suggests that it's considering this in the aggregate. And again, like I know your honors have seen agency decisions where they paid short shrift to the analysis or the evidence, and I mean the length and thoroughness of the agency's decisions here, I think indicate that they've considered it in the aggregate. And notwithstanding that, I think that acquiescence determination has not even been challenged. And putting aside the aggregation argument, you can affirm on that because there was no challenge to that. So I know your honors are familiar with the separate steps to the CAT analysis, and that was cited in Cornell, including specific intent and acquiescence. And so I think you can deny the petition for review just based on the acquiescence and waiver. So I'm over my time. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer it.
Let me see if either of my colleagues have any additional questions.
Okay.
Nope, we have no additional questions.
Okay, I'm sorry I went so fast. It was just there's a lot to talk about.
All right. Well, no, I could understand you. So stay on.
Okay. Okay, I'm here.
The appellant has rebuttal, 2 minutes and 29 seconds for rebuttal. Go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. So just focusing first on the AGFEL issue, it's completely correct that the evolution of the categorical and modified categorical approach has been complicated and long-winded. But the issues before this court are not so complicated, and it only becomes complicated when we try to reconcile Duenas-Alvarez with Mathis using pre-Mathis authority that could not predict and was not approved by the Supreme Court in Mathis. I want to be very clear that Mathis did not adopt Duenas-Alvarez's approach to divisibility, and it only cited to Rendon insofar as it wanted to illustrate the really distinct circuit split on this precise issue. And so what the court has before it today is an opportunity to do exactly what Chief Judge Thomas recommended in his concurrence, which is to take this opportunity and reconcile this issue. There is a clear irreconcilability between these two cases, and these cases will continue to come before this court if we don't make a decision. And I want to focus really quickly on the modified categorical approach, which I did not address earlier. And the record here is actually identical to that in Vidal and Arriaga-Pinon. And Vidal makes quite clear that the pleading language commonly used is to the generic for 10851, and that alone is insufficient. And that's all we have here. We do not have a factual basis for the plea, and that's what's required for the government to prevail on this issue. And absent that, Mr. Lopez-Marroquin does prevail if the court proceeds to the modified categorical approach. And turning very quickly to the merits of the case, when we look at the PSC issue, that is something that this court reviews de novo. And as Judge Wynn said, the court did not address the schizophrenia, the symptoms of schizophrenia, and it used the lack of a diagnosis as a basis to just end the analysis there, and that was insufficient. And the BIA's reference to and factual findings is separate regulatory error that entitles Mr. Lopez-Marroquin to remand on that basis. And when we look at the CAT issue, that is also something that this court reviews de novo. And the withholding analysis was not sufficient to satisfy the IJ's obligation to aggregate all sources of torture. And so what she had to do in that moment was look at every potential source of torture and see whether combined it was more likely than not that Mr. Lopez-Marroquin would suffer torture. And the IJ did not do that, and nor did the BIA. And for those reasons, we submit.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments in this matter. And this matter will now stand submitted. And this court is in recess until tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
We thank our colleague because
it's 7 o'clock her time. So yes. We'll thank you, counsel, and we appreciate all your prepared arguments. Thank you.
Your honors.
Thank you.
This court for this session stands adjourned.